Thank you very much indeed for the opportunity to come and talk about ebooks in a library context. I'd like to address discoverability from an end-user point of view. Chris has put the librarian's point of view brilliantly. He's been a fantastic advocate for us, actually, and an awful lot of what I'm going to say in the next 20 minutes will come back to points that he's made very eloquently and better than I will, actually. So I will direct you to Chris as my advocate. What I want to look at, as I say, is discoverability from the end user's point of view, the avenues of approach that connect the academic user with ebook content, so how they get there, also whether they get there. Unlike a printed or physical book, digital material can reside in many places at once. You can't put a physical book at different points in a library, not unless you buy multiple copies, and librarians are resistant to the idea of putting different copies in different places. We like them all to go together. But as Clay Shirky points out, if there's no physical constraint, there's no shelf, and you can effectively put your digital book in many places simultaneously. Not only can you link to it from multiple sites and thus create many pathways, many discovery routes, but also if one person starts reading, it doesn't withdraw the text from anybody else, so it's still accessible. You can have it in the library, and in the VLE, and on the student's laptop at home, and in the bus. Okay, so the links, as Shirky says, are enough. In the JISC 2008 ebook survey, one Cambridge respondent concurred with this view enthusiastically. I find electronic books to be the best thing that happened in publishing in the last years, as it makes it possible for information to be available anywhere, at any time. But what this doesn't take into account is some of the barriers to discovery. The sheer volume of information that's available anywhere at any time is one. But there's also the myriad different ways and containers in which information can be indexed and cited and packaged and generally made available. Information is not homogeneous. And if an item is available to many people via many channels, and still the end user is not finding it, clearly we have a problem. So where do we put the links? Where do we put them to maximize the discoverability of e-textbooks by library users? In other words, what pathways are our users following and where are they starting from? To describe this landscape, I'd like to acknowledge the work of a number of colleagues at Cambridge, including ebook surveys carried out by Sarah Stanford and the ebooks at Cambridge team, also research by Louisa Brown for her master's dissertation on ebooks in the academic library. In addition, I've drawn on two excellent and very wide-ranging reports from the Cambridge Arcadia project, one on undergraduate information needs by Liz Edwards-Waller, the other on postgraduate information needs and management by Esther Dingley, and those reports are available online. All of these sources emphasise that our accepted beliefs about how and where students or researchers at every level look for information need revision. For example, it's generally assumed that the most common way in to discovering academic ebooks is the library catalogue, the OPAC. I'd like to suggest, rather heretically, that this isn't the case, and that the discovery routes are more disparate and more nebulous than we might think. Let's start with the humble reading list. Here's a communication channel that's really solid, really reliable. It tells students what to look for. They're given, or they should be given, decent references with correctly formed titles, such as library catalogues love. But the lists themselves also carry authority, the gravitas of the supervisor who distributes them. They are trusted sources. If librarians have been able to get their hands on them, there's a very good chance that a library class mark or a URL will have found its way onto the end of each reference as well. But the discovery element belongs with the reading list. It doesn't belong to the library catalogue. Yeah? The catalogue is only acting as a finding aid connecting the end user with a known item that's been discovered somewhere else. And actually, for this very reason, I would like to reiterate Chris's plea about metadata. This is also a request from the eBooks at Cambridge team. Please give us catalogue records for your eBooks. Just records is good. Records with the correct format and coding, even better. Records for the actual electronic title as opposed to the print one, better still. Records with hyperlinks that go to the ebook as opposed to the publisher's website, absolutely awesome. If we're going to stand a chance of the OPAC even working as a finding aid, we need those basic reliable metadata. But are we there yet when it comes to connecting users with known item ebooks? Well, to some extent, yes. Ebooks at Cambridge project was designed to facilitate precisely the situation where we have lots of students working from the same reading list, all being guided to the same few precious sources all in the same week. The ebooks team prioritises core undergraduate textbooks, with selection based on reading lists and most borrowed lists from college and departmental libraries. We have well over 1,000 e-textbooks, sourced from a wide range of suppliers, and we had 22,000 ebooks hits last autumn term alone. So given these figures, you don't know whether to be frustrated or elated when a survey respondent says, Cambridge doesn't have that many ebooks. I've used like two. So is it great that they found the right two e-books they need out of our 1200+, or is it terrible that they haven't found the others even though they might be useful? What about responses that have come into our local surveys along the lines of, I have never heard of e-books from my library. I haven't got around to learning where and how to get hold of it, and I'm not really sure what e-books are, stroke how to use them. Then there was a focus group participant who shared an online service that he'd stumbled across called My iLibrary, and he was really excited about this, and he could not wait to let us know about it in the library. And for anyone who's not familiar with the resource, let me mention that My iLibrary is a subscription ebook database that the library had bought and was making available. He just thought he'd found it by himself. Which he had found it by himself. That's kind of what I'm trying to say. But it was us that were making it available. But going from a citation to a recommended resource is only the foundation level of studying. The reading list culture guides students to the right themes and contexts in their field, introduces good practice in crafting an argument. But it doesn't build a sense of critical evaluation, and it does even less to educate students in knowing where to go to find information and how to search for it. And this is why some librarians are in fact against putting URLs and class marks into reading lists, because they argue that this should be a teachable moment for students, that they should learn from it where to start looking and how to translate the needed item into a searchable term. Because at some point, the higher education student has to move on from what I call Rumsfeld Level 1, which is the known knowns. You need me to explain Rumsfeld and known knowns? I didn't think so. The student has to move on to new territory. They have to start looking at known unknowns, yeah, branching out from what's familiar to new material, filling in the gaps in knowledge. Getting into dissertation work, it pushes this whole thing further. Well, a PhD is the ultimate journey into the Rumsfeld Level 3, unknown unknowns. Yeah, what you don't know, you don't know. Apparently Rumsfeld is on record as saying, I didn't mean to say anything quotable. I like that. So now let's look at where students go when they move on from this reassuring pathway of the reading list. And where they move into is actually very anxious territory. Many of you will be familiar with the concept of slicing, when a user feels perfectly happy with the quantity of information received, and they don't place it relative to the total volume of information available. Well, it's a fair question. How do you know nowadays how much is enough? But many students, particularly postgraduates and researchers, suffer from a kind of anti-sufficing. They have to fight their way through what one student memorably described as a snowstorm of information. But they're also under pressure to be completely familiar with and comprehensive in their topic. They're exploring different kinds of resources made available via wildly varying interfaces. But because finding and storing and retrieving and evaluating the right information is so time-consuming in itself, they're frequently running to stay in the same place, like the Red Queen. One PhD student described how she'd been to a conference about online tools in her subject, designed to make life easier, but she didn't have time to follow any of them up. And this phenomenon of being swallowed up by your research so that you have no time to spend learning about things that can save you time should mean that the e-textbook is an ideal solution. And many students and researchers do see it so. They're immensely grateful for e-books. They're a blessing. They're a lifesaver. I don't know how I would have managed without e-books. There simply isn't time to spend hours trying to find things in a library. Back to time pressure again. It's annoying that you could have got something back at your room rather than making the big trip to the library. Could have had that as an e-book, I could have saved myself a 20-minute walk. The temptation is to regard this as laziness. 20 minutes, what's 20 minutes? I do not think that it's laziness. I think that this is part of the apparently limitless amount of stuff out there being a problem. All of which you need to get a handle on, yeah, in a very limited time. So what this time pressure means is that researchers are being pushed not just towards available what's online, not just what's available online, but what is most easily accessible online. If you think that by talking about discovery routes, I'm implying the time to weigh and evaluate different discovery routes, compare and contrast them, I'm afraid not. I'm talking about people not having the time to explore beyond the easiest route. And this is why Google is no longer primarily a proper noun, but a verb. And so let me tell you, is Google Book. Actual quote from a focus group participant, sometimes I just go off on a tangent and Google book something. I love that. Ultimate in instantaneity, by the way. Have you heard about Google Instant? Yeah, just out. It will produce results before you finish typing. I really thought this was a joke when I read it first. But no, somebody put out a tweet that said, I'm so glad Google has finally fixed search. I, for one, was sick of staring at a blank screen waiting 0.24 seconds for my results. Okay? But this is the kind of pressure that people are working under. This reflects exactly that time pressure. There is no time anymore. So in terms of avenues of approach, There's a clear divergence between the ways and places in which libraries are presenting information and the ways and places that our users are looking for it. And I've suggested in this heretical way that we should be careful about assuming that the OPAC, the traditional library catalogue, is a discovery route in its own right. Yes, it can be used as a discovery tool. This is what I do for a living. I teach people how to make OPACs work for them. But it isn't used that way. Not much. Transactional logging can show us what kind of catalogue searches users are carrying out. So are they doing author, keyword, subject searches? What are the search terms? By an overwhelming margin, most users are doing keyword searches for known items. Yeah? So they're locating things that have been discovered somewhere else again. In a few cases, we can see evidence of click-through from one record to another. And this is the chief method by which a traditional OPAC can be used as a discovery tool. And it's actually a very, very useful, very good way of doing it. You take a record for a known authoritative item, click through from the key indicators in that record, so the author, the subject headings, find new items and expand your familiarity. Librarians call this pearl growing. I really have no idea why. To me, this is much more like a spider web, and this is how I tend to explain it to students, or a bicycle wheel. You take something at the centre and you radiate outwards. So I don't do pearls. Cheap date. So guess what? That is all about how librarians think, not end users. There are very few OPAC users who do this kind of searching. And I've met a few who've discovered it by themselves, and like the My iLibrary guy, they couldn't wait to come back and tell us about this technique. But to most, the idea that you can get this kind of added value out of a library catalogue or a library portal is revolutionary. To the vast majority of them, NOPAC is a class mark finder, and it's easy to see why. The traditional library catalogue is a rather unfriendly place. It's tended to be very text-based, the records look like old-fashioned card catalogues, with impenetrable library language. And it can have a surprising amount of functionality on there, but it's kind of buried, you know, it gets missed because there's nothing encouraging people to linger or to explore. You do your search, you get your class mark, bam, you're out. There's even a bit of a kind of judgmental feel about things sometimes. If you misspell something, it's not going to help you out. It won't say, did you mean blah? And, you know, woe betide you if you do a title search, as I've seen people do for The Origin of the Species. It will just sit there and sneer. This always reminds me of going to a cash point towards the end of the month, you know, before payday, and I always expect the cash point to say, I know you're just going to buy shoes with this money, so you know what, it's only yourself you're letting down. There's this kind of judgmental air about it, you know? This does not make using an OPAC or a library portal a pleasant experience, so people don't linger. Why would they? About 20 years ago, a guy called Thomas Peters wrote an article about OPACs, and he said, it is amazing that some OPAC users willingly spend hours learning the intricacies of software they want to use on their personal computers, but they grow impatient, spending 5 minutes learning the basic commands and structure of an online catalogue in the library. And a lot of librarians still feel this today. They see the catalogue instruction as absolutely vital. It's a means of making students autonomous in their use of some of the most important information tools they provide in the institution. They're frustrated when students don't want to learn. But the reality is, there are other portals out there. There are other ways in which people are used to working. Yeah? And the library catalogue is no longer the jumping-off point. You know this already. This is why librarians keep trying for teachable moments, because nobody actually really wants to spend time, or more time than they can help, with a library catalogue. So let's go back to the A word, already mentioned by Chris. What is it that looks like a library catalogue that gives lots of bibliographic information that actually people spend not just time on, but they spend money on it too? Yes, Amazon. Of course it is. Amazon doesn't leave you cold if you misspell something. It doesn't kind of get judgmental if you get your title wrong. Yeah? It connects things up for you. It gives you suggestions as to what else you might like. It gives you a faceted breakdown of your search results so you can easily click through to what you want. Above all, it's friendly, it's attractive, it's visually appealing, and it encourages people to spend time there. And this kind of drives librarians crazy because people go there to spend money and we can give them the same stuff free, you know. But one of the most interesting aspects of reading survey responses and focus group contributions is what students themselves mean when they use the word ebooks. So in many cases, students have found genuine ebooks are subscribed resources accessed via a library catalogue, a library portal. But as with the student who used Google Book as a verb, in many cases it's very clear that students are conflating the freely available stuff with subscribed resources. And as well as Google Books, I have to tell you Amazon Search Inside is mentioned quite a lot as an online source that's treated equivalently to subscribed ebooks. That is now being seen as a source of ebookness in its own right. Okay? What this shows is that the saying that convenience trumps quality is absolutely true, but I think it needs unpacking. It's not good enough for us just to say, oh, well, you know, we give them all these things and they just don't use them. We can't do that. We cannot condemn students and researchers. We have to realise the pressures that they're under, to recognise the right amount of information, the level they're working at, then obtain it, then store it, then tag it, then retrieve and sort it, then start working with it academically to join the academic dialogue. And all the time, they're not just being driven by deadlines, but by the fear that they're missing things. And only once we take those pressures into account can we really see that we have got to start presenting them with intuitive online sources, intuitive finding aids that will go some way to them. That is how discoverability is going to have to start working. They will gravitate to the discovery routes that are most easily accessible, that are friendly and flexible. Yeah. As an example of this, what we've done at Cambridge, at least I hope it's going to be an example of this, we have just installed new library software called AquaBrowser, as some of you may be familiar with. It presents the same information as the library catalogue, but in a much more simple and appealing way. It encourages end users to linger, or we hope it will. It gives them faceted searching, it gives them visual appeal with covers, it allows them to get an overview of their topic through the facets, but it actually does something that Amazon doesn't do. Yes! It has a real-time clickable word cloud of terms that are found in the catalogue that are related to your original search term. So this is right in there with discovery. You put in euthanasia, it'll come back with all kinds of terms related to, and you can click through and see what else is there on that subject that you didn't know about before. Straight into the unknown unknowns without having to worry about Perl growing, anything like that. But the most important thing is that new interface searches across previously disparate silos of information, and it presents the results all together. It is going to be attractive because it gives you a good overview and a good handle on information. One of the facets is ebooks, you'll be happy to know. But it's not yet the same story, not yet, with our ebooks portal. Okay? Bearing in mind the ideal is of losing the constraints of the bookshelf so that the links alone are enough, it would be awesome if we could offer the same kind of seamless integrated access to an attractive, browsable ebook interface that covers all the suppliers. At the moment, all we can do is give students a clickable list of suppliers, not even of ebook titles or subjects, because all the interfaces are so different and they don't kind of talk to one another. We have to give a clickable list of suppliers. Suppliers, I'm sorry, they don't mean anything to researchers, to students. They want titles and subjects. Yeah. We have a limited cross-platform search facility because it can't support all of the different ebook interfaces. So what we need to give them is something that will rival services like Google Books, like Amazon, a service where they're going to want to spend time, okay, in terms of friendliness and accessibility and comprehensiveness. Ooh, I'm on my last paragraph. Thank you. I'd like to end by saying that actually, the nicest thing that could happen to me as a library trainer would be not to be needed anymore. Because our systems and interfaces would be so simple, so powerful, and so engaging that nobody would need me to explain them, to teach them, to show students how to use them. They would attract the students without my intervention. So I'm going to close with one final plea to you all. Can you please do your best to put me out of a job? Thank you very much indeed.